Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Hold on tight, because we're shaking things up a bit. Now, we usually bring you the weekly politics takeaway on Fridays. But today, we're going to flip it, change it, or rearrange it. See, when you tune in tomorrow, instead of politics, you're getting a very special episode commemorating Juneteenth and celebrating Father's Day. We've been hard at work on it, so please don't miss it. That means today is politics. And we're going to check in on the Biden-Putin meetup, or was it a square-off, that happened in Geneva. We'll dig into the legal and political strategy motivating the legal challenges to targeted COVID relief. And Professor Brittany Cooper will join us to discuss the politics of time. Yes, time is political. But first, we begin in California, where there have been a lot of changes in the past year. First, the junior senator from California, well, she became the vice president.
I, Kamala Davie Harris, do solemnly swear
that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and defend.
President Joe Biden also tapped California's Attorney General Javier Becerra to lead the Department of Health and Human Services.
Mr. President-elect, Madam Vice President-elect, I am honored and excited to join your team.
And you guessed it, all this shuffling at the top left a critical vacancy in the role of California's Attorney General, a vacancy now filled with another history maker.
Rob Bonta, California Attorney General.
Rob Bonta is the first Filipino-American to serve as Attorney General of California. He assumes the role after serving for nearly a decade in the California State Assembly, representing District 18. That's the East Bay, or as rapper Too Short would remind you, now, I sat down with Attorney General Bonta earlier this week, and I asked him what inspired his life in public service.
My father marched in Selma, organizing for civil rights and voting rights. Both my parents worked for the United Farm Workers of America. We actually lived in the headquarters of La Paz in a trailer a stone's throw away from the home of Cesar Chavez. And my mom organized for the restoration of democracy in the Philippines after Ferdinand Marcos became a dictator and violated human rights repeatedly for the people of the Philippines. And it was that spirit to uplift other people and right wrongs and make people's lives better that inspired me to get into public service.
With this appointment, Bonta is finishing out the remainder of Becerra's term, which means he's up for re-election in 2022. And the primary is only about a year away. In politics, that means the campaign is already in full swing. So we spoke about taking on such a big job with such a compressed timeline.
I'm incredibly excited for the opportunity to be in this role. And yes, there's an election, in a primary election in less than a year, in June of next year. So as I have served in the role of California Attorney General, I'm also running for a full four-year term. And I think the best way, the best audition to be able to continue in the role you're in is to do a good job while you're in the role. And every day I roll up my sleeves and the first thing on my mind is how can I make the lives of Californians better today? And that's what we focus on. So many areas as we emerge from the pandemic and an economic recession, and we still confront a racial justice reckoning, a climate crisis, a homelessness and housing affordability crisis. There's so many areas where I can move the needle as California Attorney General and provide relief and comfort to those in pain and to help those who are hurting.
Let's start with one of those areas, and this is around criminal justice. So in California right now, there are these very reformed-minded district attorneys in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and the reality is that many of them, or much of what they've experienced in their reform-mindedness has been critique, criticism, some might call it attack. So I want to hear from you about sort of how you're thinking about the fundamental questions of safety and of justice and what that looks like when it comes to real policy issues like bail reform.
Well, it starts with my position that every Californian deserves to be safe in their community. And that's a top priority for me to ensure that they are safe through all the tools and the levers that I have in the California Attorney General's office. It's important to have safe communities, and I'm absolutely committed to making that happen and that is a top priority. It's also important that we look at all of our systems and make sure that they're working, that they do make people safe, that they are fair, that they are just, and fairer, more just systems in criminal justice are also safer. And so it's important to look at things like bail reform that you mentioned. Bail does not ask any question about safety, the way money bail works. The only question it asks is how much money do you have in your pocket? It doesn't ask what your risk to the community is. It doesn't ask if what the safety risk is. It doesn't even care to. All it says is how much money do you have? And it punishes poor people for being poor. It makes the jailhouse door swing open and close based on how much money is in your pocket. It's essentially pay to play. And I proposed a reform where we did ask that question. What is the safety risk of the individual, and not ask how much money do you have in your pocket, and make decisions based on actual safety risk. So that, and it's more fair that way. It's more just that way, and it's safer that way. So that's a classic example of how we can acknowledge and must acknowledge a fundamentally a broken part of our criminal justice system and can provide reform that is both safe and just.
I'd like to talk with you a little bit about police accountability. I know that you have talked about being open to an investigation potentially of the killing of Sean Monterosa by Vallejo police. I know there's a push in California to reopen the Oscar Grant killing. Where are you on these cases and on police accountability more broadly?
Police accountability is a really important part of my priorities. We are implementing a really important bill that I co-authored called Assembly Bill 1506, which requires that the California Attorney General conduct independent investigations of officer-involved shootings that result in the death of a Californian. And I know that law enforcement are critical parts of our communities and invaluable, and that the vast majority want to build that trust between law enforcement and community that is too often missing today in too many places and in too many ways. And we also need to have accountability, because you can't have trust without accountability. And accountability is critical, and something that the Attorney General has an important role in playing when it comes to the Sean Monterosa case. There was inaction and uncertainty, and I wanted to change that, and I did. We committed to conducting an independent review of that case. We're doing that now. That is happening. That decision has been made. We are in the process of conducting that independent review now. The state of California, our communities, the Vallejo community, the family of Mr. Monterosa deserve nothing less. They deserve an independent, thorough review, and for that review to go wherever the facts and the law lead.
Let's talk about accountability in another arena. California is among many things, as you said, as goes California, so goes the nation, maybe even the world. And so the question of tech firms and accountability of tech is something that, you know, is going to be critical in part for the work that you're doing. I'm interested in how you might be thinking about managing issues around enforcing consumer protection, around racial algorithmic bias in tech, and simply using your platform to push even the federal government to do more on these tech accountability questions.
Tech accountability is a top priority for me. And I see the role of the California Attorney General as being the people's attorney, of standing up for everyday people, making sure that the scales of justice are balanced, and essentially protecting the little guy from the overreach of power and the abuse of power by the big guy, whoever the big guy is, and no matter how big they are or who they are, including big tech. And it's important for consumers, for Californians, to have their privacy protected, their consumer rights vindicated and honored and respected. And if that means taking on big tech, we have and we will to make sure that the rules are being followed and that there is not manipulation or abuse that is contrary to the law. And so California is really important in this arena. So are the alliances we've built with attorneys general throughout the state, including New York and other states. We often work in tandem to identify an issue that's hurting consumers. Often if big tech is crossing a line or violating a rule in California, it is not necessarily restricted only to California. It can impact other consumers throughout the nation. So it's a top priority for me. We're working with our colleagues throughout the nation and focusing on everyday folks to make sure that they're free from abuse, treated lawfully and appropriately, and that their privacy is protected and that their consumer rights are honored.
We're in a time when much of the nation is acknowledging the violence against AAPI communities, and not only acknowledging it, but recognizing that it has been discursive violence, structural violence, and now very serious physical violence. Given your particular historic role in representing not only the state of California, but also as a Filipino American, having a very particular position around representation, will you be using your platform and your actual powers of office to address these AAPI violence issues?
Absolutely. Addressing anti-AAPI hate violence is a top priority for me. I say to the API community, I see you, I value you, I am you. And I am feeling and experiencing many of the same things that the API community generally is throughout the state and throughout the nation. We're in a full-on state of emergency, a full-on state of crisis. We are all rightfully concerned, anxious, worried, sometimes frightened, often angry about what's happening. My own mother reached out to me, 83-year-old mother, and said, I'm planning to take a lift into the city. And do you think it's safe, given all the anti-AAPI hate? And it's just an ordinary trip to attend a meeting and see some friends. And I said, I don't think it's safe. Let's make arrangements for me to take you, or for a family member to take you. And we changed plans. That is how so many API community members are feeling right now, just the fear of conducting everyday activities, running errands, going for a walk, being on public transportation. And so it's my role to stand with our API community, to fight for them, to address the forces of hate and take them on, to make sure that perpetrators of hate are held accountable and that victims are allowed to heal. And in that regard, we have set up the Racial Justice Bureau in the California Attorney General's office to take on organizations that are organized around hate and white supremacy, to work with local law enforcement to make sure that they know all the best practices to investigate and identify hate crimes and acts of hate violence and bring those who perpetrate those acts to justice, that we're working on other issues to protect our community members, like campus climate issues, making sure that young people are treated with support services and healing instead of punitive and discriminatory policies. So we are focusing on racial and social justice and addressing the urgency of now with hate violence in our Racial Justice Bureau and with other work that we have within the Attorney General's office. So we can provide the support, healing, and be the champion that our API communities need right now.
Attorney General, just real quick, we talked at the very beginning about now having to run for office relatively swiftly after being appointed. Do you have any candidate that you might be endorsing for your former assembly seat?
I do. I am endorsing an incredible leader named Mia Bonta, the president of the Alameda School Board, and a powerful leader for social and racial and economic justice. Congressmember Barbara Lee is also endorsing her. And there's no one I believe in more. I've known her since I was 17 years old. That's when we met. We've been partners in life and partners in service. And having served this incredible assembly district, which I believe is the most enlightened and most social justice oriented in the entire state, and having the honor and privilege of representing this district and knowing what it takes over the last almost decade, I know that she will be an incredible leader and have everything that it takes and more to provide the service and leadership that this district deserves.
Attorney General Rob Bonta, California's new Attorney General, thank you for joining me today.
Honored to be with you, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Small businesses owned by people of color have been hit particularly hard by pandemic-related economic crisis. Between March and April of 2020, 42% of Black-owned businesses and 32% of Latino-owned businesses closed their doors. And that's compared to less than 20% of white-owned businesses. That's according to the National Bureau of Economic Research. Now, reporting last year from the Associated Press found that thousands of minority business owners had to wait months longer than their white counterparts for Payment Protection Plan, or PPP, loans approved under the Trump administration's COVID relief packages. These disparities were one reason that restaurant owners of color were encouraged by a Biden administration program intended to prioritize disadvantaged groups applying for federal grants to help their restaurants stay afloat.
My name is Gregory Leon, and I'm the chef and sole proprietor of Amalinda, a small Spanish and Portuguese independently owned restaurant in downtown Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I'm of Latino descent. I'm also LGBTQ. And so this was going to help us. You know, in the past, when we've applied for other programs, usually we haven't been approved because of the amount of people that are applying. Big corporations, big restaurant groups are always seem to be getting these big fat checks. And the little guy, I own this restaurant by myself. This is a small little restaurant. Was going to be able to help us get a leg up. It's like, okay, great. We can apply first and maybe we can get these funds and then we can continue doing the work that we're doing.
But last weekend, Gregory and nearly 3,000 other restaurant owners who had initially been approved for federal grants under the government's prioritization program found out their funds weren't going to go through after all.
We received the letter saying that we had been approved on the 28th of May. The original letter said that we would have gotten our funds deposited in our account 3 to 10 business days. At day number 8, I was getting a little antsy. So I called and they said, oh, there's been a glitch in the system. You'll receive it 10 to 14 days. And this past Sunday, I received a letter saying that we would not receive the funds because of the lawsuit.
The lawsuits that put these grants on hold are backed by conservative groups led by former Trump administration officials, including Stephen Miller and Mark Meadows. Filed on behalf of white male restaurant owners, they argue that prioritizing people of color and women for federal relief is discriminatory towards white men. And rulings in favor of white male plaintiffs mean that the financial future of restaurants like Amalinda is now in jeopardy.
Basically, what has happened is that everybody who was put on hold, 2,900 of us, were just kind of moved off to the side. And everybody who applied after us in the non-grace period, they're going to start getting their funds until this program runs out of money. The only way I will receive the award that was granted to me is if Congress refills this account. I wish I could tell you what the future holds for myself and Amalinda. You know, my staff is amazing. And, you know, we've had several meetings and we're just going to continue to chug along as long as we can, just doing what we're doing right now. Will Amalinda be here by the end of the summer? It's hard to tell. I wish I could say yes, but I can't say that with certainty. And it saddens me to say that.
For more on why this reverse discrimination legal strategy has succeeded recently, I'm joined by Alexis Carteron, Associate Professor of Law and Director of the Constitutional Rights Clinic at Rutgers Law School. Alexis, it's great to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So what have courts traditionally allowed when it comes to government programs that are going to prioritize folks based on race or gender or some intersection of those?
Well, it's been a project of the conservative legal movement for decades now to eradicate any kind of preferences on the basis of race, whether in contracting, government grant programs, education. So courts have been very hostile, I think it's fair to say, to these kinds of programs for a very long time, making these rulings that have come out in the last couple of weeks fairly unsurprising.
So let's talk about some of those rulings. I mean, clearly we're talking here about this prioritization program, but we also talked earlier in the week about the Black Farmers Debt Relief Program. Have there been others?
Those are the two that I have in mind. Those seem to be the two that are making the news lately.
So let's talk a little bit about the courts. So I know it can feel as though the Supreme Court is the only thing that we talk about sort of in national media, but who are these decision makers who are looking at these federal programs and deciding that prioritizing certain identities is the problem?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that because although, as you said, the Supreme Court gets so much attention and makes so much news, they actually decide a pretty small number of cases every year. And instead, these cases really mostly are decided by the lower federal courts, federal district courts, and federal courts of appeals, with judges that most of us don't know the names of, but who, again, are, I think, expressing real hostility to these kinds of programs that try to address historical, ongoing societal discrimination against people of color.
So you and I are both in the Academy, and I feel like I remember this beginning to happen in the Academy now 15 years ago, and the notion that you could make a claim towards race-based preferences, but only if it was for the purpose of diversifying undergraduate students or graduate students. It couldn't be made on the basis of redressing past wrongs. Is that part of what's happening in terms of the legal reasoning here?
Yes, absolutely. So you're right. I think it's actually probably been closer to 20 years now ago that the Supreme Court decided that diversity could, in fact, be a compelling interest that could be used to justify race-based affirmative action in higher education. But it was long before that that the conservative legal movement targeted race-based programs outside of education. So there, decades ago, around in the early 1990s, there were a series of cases where the Supreme Court confronted programs that were designed to ensure that contracting bids from, say, local governments or state governments, that maybe a certain percentage of them went to businesses that were owned by people of color. And the Supreme Court said that governments, local governments, state governments, they could not do that if they had the goal of confronting or remedying societal discrimination in general, that they had to be remedying something that they themselves had done intentionally, and that the redress that they were trying to create could only go to the people who had been clear victims of intentional governmental discrimination. So in this area, the law has been pretty hostile to programs like this for a long time, even predating the Supreme Court's treatment in higher education regarding diversity.
Can you talk a little bit more about the court and the way that it's thought about the intent of discriminatory behavior versus the effects, the sort of outcomes of discriminatory policy?
Sure. So dating back to the 1970s, the Supreme Court held that attempting to address race discrimination could only be done if that discrimination was intentional. So it basically said you can't look at outcomes. You can't say, okay, there's a racial disparity here, and I, as the government, want to address it. That doesn't constitute unconstitutional race discrimination unless there was an intention by the government to discriminate on the basis of race. And so, again, that dates back to a case called Washington v. Davis that was decided way back in 1976. And that animates kind of everything we know about how to address race discrimination in a constitutional, when there's a constitutional question about it.
And how would one demonstrate intention? Do you need a smoking gun email with racist language, for example?
That would be a good way to show it. And I think there's a lot of concern that the courts have defined discrimination so narrowly now, and intentional discrimination so narrowly, that, yeah, smoking gun email is one of the few ways that you can show it. You know, you can use disparities as evidence of intentional discrimination, for sure, but there really needs to be something that goes beyond that. You know, there are occasionally cases that you see where a plaintiff can successfully show that there's been intentional discrimination with something besides a smoking gun email, but it's definitely a real challenge.
So this might be an unfair question to ask a law professor, but is this evidence that the courts simply can't bring racial justice, that the kind of narrow construction of it always being about that one individual case and these particular plaintiffs and the particular standing, does that mean we actually can't redress the big social structural that often don't have the smoking gun email?
I think it's a very good question to ask. You know, it's really been striking in the last year that it feels like there's a really big disconnect between the conversation in the courts and the legal academy about how to define racial discrimination that is unconstitutional, and the conversation at large that our society is having about what racial discrimination looks like. So yeah, I think it's a very good question to ask. And the courts are continuing to stick to the very narrow conception that has been the prevailing definition since the 1970s. And we should think really hard about whether the courts are the place where racial justice can be achieved.
Is it in part a question also of the ways in which the federal bench was so dramatically reshaped under the Trump administration, not again, not just at the Supreme Court, but throughout the federal judiciary?
Well, I think looking at the lower courts, yes, President Trump worked hard and was successful at putting a lot of pretty conservative people on the courts. And I think, you know, there are at least some of his nominees who wouldn't even say that Brown versus Board of Education was decided in the right way. In their confirmation hearings, they basically declined to answer the question. So that gives you a sense that the federal courts are not necessarily places that are going to be particularly welcoming to claims regarding racial discrimination. And again, this is where most of these cases will be decided, because the Supreme Court really hears a very small number of cases. So when you look at the landscape of the federal judiciary, I think it's fair to say it is not exactly friendly territory for claims involving racial discrimination.
Alexis Carteron is an associate professor of law and director of the Constitutional Rights Clinic at Rutgers Law School. Alexis, thank you so much for walking us through all of this.
No, thanks for having me.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Yesterday, President Joe Biden met with Russian President Vladimir Putin for the first time since Biden took the oath of office. And the highly anticipated summit took place in Geneva, where they were expected to discuss a number of issues, including cyber attacks, human rights abuses, and the exchange of foreign prisoners. According to both presidents, the two adversarial nations had an amicable and constructive summit, although it's not totally clear whether any progress was made during these talks.
So human rights is going to always be on the table, I told them. It's not about just going after Russia when they violate human rights. It's about who we are.
We sympathize with what happened in the United States, but we have no desire to allow the same thing to happen in our country.
Joining us now to help us understand what exactly happened during this meeting is Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. Anita, so great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So what were the accomplishments? Were there any accomplishments from this relatively brief meeting?
We're still going to see what happens, but the two countries did appear to agree to continue to talk on a couple things, that they're going to have staff really talk about cyber attacks. President Biden said he told President Putin, look, here are these 16 areas where we feel like there should be no cyber attacks. They should be off limits. The second thing is arms control. Now, this is something that the two countries had been working on before and had reached some agreements. So they want to continue talking about that. And then I think probably the most immediate thing we'll see is the two ambassadors. So the U.S. ambassador to Russia and the Russian ambassador to the U.S. had left each other's countries. They will return to those countries. So that's something we're going to see immediately, is that there'll be representation in each of those countries.
prior to the meeting, this was being billed as potentially like a prize fight, you know, kind of all this language about how tense it was going to be. It certainly wasn't like they came out, you know, best buddies, but did it feel as though maybe there was a decision to thaw any growing new Cold War?
Yeah, it was really interesting. Both of them came out pretty, you know, complimentary. I mean, I was surprised at President Putin's news conference. He actually went out of his way to compliment President Biden as a statesman and someone that, you know, he had a cordial relationship with. I wasn't sure we were going to hear that because it appeared, you know, before to me that he had sort of had more of a cozy relationship with President Trump. And President Biden said, look, it was a good talk. So, you know, definitely, I don't know that this is the beginning of any huge relationship there, but it was very noticeable that they say that they can talk to each other, that it was cordial, that they could continue to talk. That was very noticeable.
Of course, a relationship or warmth with Putin kind of cuts two ways for the American domestic public, right? I mean, and Putin is always quite strategic. I'm wondering if that relative warmth is a good thing or a bad thing for President Biden as he's looking at these declining numbers with the U.S. population.
Before we left on this trip, that was what so many people were talking about, was how is this going to look politically? As you know, President Biden was getting a lot of criticism, primarily from Republicans, before he left, that this meeting shouldn't even happen, that President Biden shouldn't, you know, quote, reward President Putin with a meeting that made it look like the U.S. and Russia were on the same page. So now we're going to see what's going to happen here. Are people going to say, look, it's great that they're having that conversation, they started that? Or are they going to say, look, they didn't get anything out of it? And we just don't know what President Biden's going to get out of this. As he said yesterday, it really depends on what happens over the next 3 to 6 months. Do these things they talk about really turn into anything or not? If they don't, it's going to look like, hey, it's another U.S. president who believed what President Putin said and didn't get any deliverables.
So we don't know what will happen, but do we know what Biden wants to happen?
He wants at the staff level, his staff and President Putin's staff to sit down and sort of work on some of these issues that we talked about and then come back to them and say, look, this is what we came up with. So he does want some agreements. We just don't have those agreements yet. It was noticeable to me that neither president said, hey, look, we're agreeing to meet again, either in Russia or in the United States. We're agreeing to meet in a third country. They didn't say that. I don't think there's any plans for them to continue talking. It'll kind of depend on, you know, what happens in these coming weeks and months.
Anita Kumar is the White House correspondent and associate editor for Politico. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This Saturday, Black communities around the country will be observing Juneteenth with pageants, parades, festivals, and family gatherings. But for all this celebration, Juneteenth is not an uncomplicated holiday. Because Juneteenth not only celebrates freedom, it also commemorates theft. The theft of two full years when Black people in Texas remained enslaved despite the fact that the Emancipation Proclamation had legally granted them freedom. Juneteenth is about what is gained, but it is also about what was lost. Time. And time matters. It matters in ways that are racialized and radicalized. Think of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. explaining why we can't wait as he spoke of, quote, the fierce urgency of now. King said in 1967, quote, in this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. Or turn to the words of scholar Brittany Cooper, who makes this claim about time in her 2019 TED Talk.
We Black people have always been out of time. Time does not belong to us. Our lives are lives of perpetual urgency.
So what does all of that mean? Let's just look at a few examples. Take the COVID-19 pandemic, which saw an already significant life expectancy gap widen even further. In just 6 months in 2020, Black men lost 3 years of life expectancy. Time. Let's also look at Black labor. At the turn of the century, there were codes, laws that made it illegal to rest, illegal to take time off. And then think about Juneteenth. This holiday exists because for 2 years, Black people in parts of Texas were kept in bondage, even when as a matter of law, they should have been free. 2 years stolen from Black people after all the decades and centuries of time that had already been stolen by slavery itself. So when we hear people like Congresswoman Maxine Waters insist that she is reclaiming her time.
Reclaiming my time.
Several times.
Reclaiming my
when
time.
We were doing our...
It's an act of rebellion, of freedom. To control one's time is to resist.
Reclaiming my time.
The time belongs to the gentlelady from California.
Let me just say to you, thank you for your compliments about how great I am, but I don't want to waste my time on me.
Here to talk more about race and time is Professor Brittany Cooper, professor at Rutgers University and author of Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. Brittany, always so great to have an opportunity to talk to you.
Hey, Melissa, good to talk to you.
So I've been spending a lot of time with your 2019 TED Talk on time. Let me play one more clip.
Sure. For if time had a race, it would be white. White people own time.
All right, expand on that.
Look, I was being provocative, but essentially trying to say that white people, particularly during the, you know, during the era of, you know, European exploration and colonization, decided that Black people were not a part of history. And so they made these huge philosophical claims like Africa is no historical part of the world and that everything that happened where Black folks lived was prehistoric and therefore not particularly significant. So they offered a concept of time that was really about their own desires for power, which meant that, for instance, when they, you know, sailed across the ocean and took land from indigenous people, what they were essentially asserting is that everything that had happened before Europeans showed up didn't matter. That's an argument about time. But I also like the way that George Lipsitz puts it in a more sort of recent iteration where he says, look, white people act and I'm paraphrasing. He says, white people act like they own time because when Black people make claims about we want freedom now, you know, white people are like, well, just hold on. Let's be gradual. Slow down. Right. All of that is about saying that they get to control the pace at which Black people are included in the democratic experiment.
And I think for me, that aspect, that idea of wait, pause is part of what makes this Juneteenth moment so painful that on the one hand, it is that celebration of freedom, but it's also like y'all 2 more whole years after everything else that was stolen. And when I think of what was lost in those 2 years, like, I feel like we have to really let that sink in.
Yeah. I mean, look, there were Black people who didn't live to see the end of that 2 years, right? Black people who were legally free, who died under conditions of enslavement because somebody simply callously refused to tell them. And when we think about the way the simplicity of white racial devastation in Black lives, that simply the withholding of information makes the difference between whether you are in control of your will, your body, your life, your time, or someone else is, it's absolutely staggering, and it deserves for us to take a breath and to really sit with the profundity of that.
I spoke with Alma Adams earlier this week, Representative Alma Adams, about the delay occurring in the USDA's meant to be, you know, payout for debt relief for Black farmers. It's been delayed now by the courts. And again, I was thinking about this issue of time. How many more acres of land will be lost because of time?
That's right. I mean, look, I was infuriated when I saw these farmers have waited forever. And when we think about the fact that so much of Black people's contribution and labor to the country has been in the space of agriculture and that farmers were discriminated against by the USDA, that this was the government finally admitting that they did something wrong and that they owed redress. And then 12 conservative white farmers could slow that up. So even the government acting on behalf of Black people can be stopped by politically motivated judges. And, you know, like, just barely enough, just a little bit over what it takes to have a football team can stop the flow of progress. That's entirely too much power to have. It makes me think even politically when we, you know, like, this is why I'm so mad sometimes at the way that Joe Manchin wields power, because it doesn't occur to him that one white man should not be able to determine whether Black people have a secure form of participating in democracy or not. But that's this incredible white ability uniquely to slow down time.
Mm. So I want to think about another aspect of lost time that or stolen, but I want to think really specifically about this pandemic and the effect of the lost time relative to education. And particularly this gap, which had already existed between students in schools with a lot of resources and students in schools with very few resources. We know that also tends to be racialized, and it widened so dramatically over the past two academic years. I'm just wondering about how we even begin to think about reclaiming that time and creating some time justice for those young people.
No, it's a really good question. And I'm not sure that I have the solution. But I had a brief stint as a middle school reading teacher before I went on to become an academic. And one of the things we knew at the time was that for every year that a kid falls behind in terms of reaching their reading benchmarks, it takes them 2 years to make that time up. And so when we're talking about 2 years of lost time, we're really talking about 4 years of lost time. And so I think that we've got to have a full court press here to say, you know, we've got to resource schools more. We've got to figure out how to give people access to the digital tools and resources that they need. I also think, though, that we've got to figure out a different pipeline. And so maybe it becomes the case that folks that we sort of think about education on an extended timeline. And so what does it mean to say that, you know, we'll pay for the, you know, community college, we'll pay for your, you know, some portion of your undergraduate education, and that we'll pay for those benefits, you know, beyond the initial amount of time that it would have taken you to get through K through 12. So we'll add an additional 2 years onto that. But some of this has to be, I think, a broader cultural shift about us not stigmatizing this kind of winner-take-all process that's about overachievers, that says there's to be a linear end to, you know, you go through K through 12, you go through college, you make it into the middle class. It's such a limiting narrative. It never worked for Black people to begin with. And I do think that all of the kids that graduated from high school in this time frame and started college, because they've had to take gap years and all of this and have had such disruption, I think they're going to show us what it means to redefine what you do with this, you know, this lifetime, this life stage break that none of us asked for. Yeah,
I so appreciate that you make that point, that when time doesn't work for Black folks in a particular way, it usually means it is problematic, oppressive in these broader ways as well. And so addressing it is good for us all in important ways. So let's talk about reclaiming our time in this moment when work and home life have blurred, when the hours that people put in are so much longer. How can we begin to think about reclaiming our time?
I mean, look, my favorite quote from the Maxine Waters conversation with Steve Mnuchin is when she said, "You forget that when you are on my time, I can reclaim it." And I think that that assertion of like, hey, white folks' calendars aren't the only calendars that matter, are important. And so one of the places I actually see this happening is the way that, you know, workers and sort of essential workers and laborers in minimum wage labor are not rushing back to jobs that devalue their time structurally. And they're like, wait, we're going to take this, you know, government, you know, half funded sabbatical. It's not really that, but the government actually doing something right to take care of its citizens. And we're going to think about where we want to be. I love that, because when do folks who work minimum wage jobs actually get the time to take a beat and say, how do I want to go about the rest of my life? I think that that's a reclamation of time. And I think that's also why you're seeing such, you know, you know, such anger on the right about, you know, how dare these folks not go back into these terrible jobs with poor benefits and even worse pay.
But doesn't it feel like those black codes that said, if you're not employed by the white man, then you can be incarcerated? I mean, I just keep feeling like the underlying source is like, why won't these folks just go back and work these jobs that don't even bother to pay a living wage?
Absolutely. I mean, look, all of the, you know, we're continually dealing with a labor system that gets its prototype and its, you know, its sort of blueprint from the exploitation of black labor and the sense that black people are supposed to be working all the time, but also that black people and increasingly brown people, that we're all supposed to be working so that white people can lead lives of ease. And that at any point that we disrupt that, you know, I've been reading slave narratives, just as part of my own sort of Juneteenth commemoration, and folks talked about the harsh punishments when they, you know, when they didn't get up for work quickly. But the thing that I loved is that even during periods of enslavement, sometimes black people were like, look, I'm just going to take this nap and I'll deal with the consequences. And, you know, the consequences were terrible for them. But I think that part of the then mandate for us is to do like Trisha Hershey says in the Nap Ministry, which is take the nap. Take the day off, take the paid time off. Don't rush back to these terrible jobs. Put the government in a position where it has to negotiate, you know, where it forces these businesses to raise their wages. You know, every state isn't going to do that. Some of them are just going to strip these benefits. But I do think that these workers are forcing the conversation. And I just think that's so important.
All right, listen, you just revolutionized my whole thought about planning for future Juneteenth events. No more having to cook all day. I think we should just put out red, black, and green mats and say, listen, black folks are taking a nap today. We'll get back with you on June 20th.
That's right. We reclaiming our 2.5 years that you stole and all the other things that you stole. But I also wanted to say too, one of the quotes that keeps me anchored when I, you know, think about this, because, you know, often black people are like, well, we don't want, you know, we need to be grinding, you know, they grind, you know, they sleep, we grind, all of this stuff. And it's like, A, reject that, but B, James Baldwin is one of the most trenchant thinkers on this. And in his, you know, in his 1980s book, The Price of the Ticket, he says, look, how much time do you want for your progress? And that is the thing that I think that black people have to start thinking about. We have to reclaim time by saying, how much time do we actually need to make up for all that has been stolen? And while I don't know that we will ever be able to reach historical parity on that point, I do think we have to start making it up in every intentional demand that we have for joy, for rest, for, you know, look, because in the end, we can't win the battle always with longevity, because of course things like COVID come in and decimate our communities. And in a moment when you can't quite figure out how to extend lifespan, what you can do is battle for quality of life. And that's something that people with disabilities have taught me. They say, look, you know, in their theory of crip time, they say, look, sometimes the way our bodies are set, we don't get a long time, but what we can demand from the government and from those around us is that the time that we do have is quality time. And I do think that black people have to start thinking about how to fill up the space that we do have.
Yes. And I'll remind you, you are not your ancestors' wildest dream. Their wildest dream was for joy and for freedom in their own lifetime. So we're going to have to fulfill our own wildest dreams by reclaiming our time. Brittany Cooper is a friend of mine. She's also a professor at Rutgers University and the author of Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. Brittany, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Good to talk to you.
Okay, folks, that's the show, and we hope you enjoyed it. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check out our Juneteenth special tomorrow. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.